MechCast, Wednesday, August 26th, 2015. Hey, Mech Geeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for Mech Geeks by Mech Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the podcast. Well, I hope you are having a great week. It's actually turned out to be a pretty good week in Apple and Mac news. We got a lot of stuff to talk about this week. I'm looking through the show notes, and we got a lot of things going on here. Just some of the highlights. We're going to be talking about Apple Music. What's going on there? Are they possibly losing subscribers? Changes to Apple retail. A lot of stuff happening in your Apple retail store. Next time you go in there, you might notice some new things. Apple has a new ad highlighting Apple Pay. We're going to talk about Apple's next event, the big iPhone 6S, 6S Plus event. There may be a venue change going on, which is somewhat interesting. Some people are getting deep in the weeds on what kind of aluminum might be in the next iPhone. Want to figure out what's that all about. We're going to talk about that a little bit. Also, maybe some upgrades for your Apple Watch. Interesting news there. And a story about some eyesight issues in some iPhone 6S Pluses. There's a little program going on. If you're experiencing that, you may be able to take advantage. We have that. And, of course, your feedback. Gary wants to know, hey, what are we doing with our Apple Watches? We'll get into that a little bit. Also, an issue from listener Jim with dates on imported photos. And then I'm going to share with you my most recent experience with the Genius Bar. And a little hint, it didn't go as well as it has in the past. So I'm gonna rant a little bit, and that's always fun, right? But before we get into all of that, I want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Tunnel Bear. And if you don't know what Tunnel Bear is yet, I will let you know. It is very simple to use, really great VPN software for your Mac. It allows you to browse privately and get around blocked websites. You can check it out at tunnelbear.com/maccast, and it is great. I've tried a few VPN things, and I have to say theirs is really one of the easiest. Once you install it, puts a little thing up in your menu bar. You've really got two clicks, right? You click it on, so you want to turn on your VPN. It'll ask you what country you want to look like you're browsing from, and then away you go. They have over 5 million users, so a lot of people using the service, and it just allows you to browse the internet privately, get around censored and sites and unblock websites that might be blocked. It also encrypts your traffic, so you're going to be protected from the prying eyes of governments, ISP corporations, but probably more importantly, that creepy guy sitting in the corner at the coffee shop. You know that guy with the black laptop and all the black clothes? He's kind of got the hacker stickers all over the outside of his laptop. Yeah, that's the guy you got to worry about. He's sitting there sniffing traffic, and you don't want that traffic when you're using public Wi-Fi hotspots. Maybe you're traveling, working in a cafe. You don't want anybody prying in on that stuff. And I'm joking around a little bit, but, you know, security in public Wi-Fi places is really important, and Tunnel Bear can help you get that quickly and easily. They have apps for your mobile devices, for your desktop, and your browsers on iOS, Mac, Chrome. They've got you covered across the board, and literally you can turn it on, like I said, in a single click. You can tunnel from 14 different countries, and it allows you to browse the internet as if you're in a different country. So if you're facing censorship or need to get around that stuff, it'll let you do that as well. And one thing that is really important when you're picking a VPN service is trust. You have to be able to trust them with your traffic as well. And what I loved about the Tunnel Bear service was when I went to check out the website, everything on their site is in plain English. They tell you right up front the kinds of stuff they need to collect, and they only collect the bare minimum of information from you. They have very transparent policies, more so than I've seen in any other service. And it's all right there in plain English. And they even have a little fun with it, with the whole bear theme and things like that. It's really great. And pricing is amazing. You can use the service for free for up to 500 megabytes per month. After that, if you need more, you can get unlimited for just $4.99 a month or $49.99 a year. and that covers up to 3 computers or devices. So it's going to cover everything you want to use, your Mac, your iPhone, your iPad. You're good to go. So I want you to try it out now. Just go to tunnelbear.com/Maccast, and you can get all the information, get the software, and check it out. It is really great. And a big thank you to Tunnel Bear for their support of the Maccast. So let's start off the news for this week talking a little bit about Apple Music. Mac Rumors had a story with numbers from Music Watch that paints a pretty bleak outlook for Apple Music. Music Watch, in August of 2015, they surveyed about 5,000 U.S. consumers aged 13 and older, and they found that while 77% of users were aware of Apple Music, about 11% were actually currently using the streaming service. Now, remember, Apple Music is available in 100 countries, so as we're going through these numbers, this was a U.S.-only survey, so it might not wholly represent the Apple Music service worldwide. Just keep that in mind. They also claimed that of those who tried the Apple Music service, 40% said that they were no longer using it, and they said that 61% had already turned off the auto-renew subscription option in iTunes. And that's a really important key for Apple having Apple Music be successful. They need to grab subscribers and get them to continue to pay. Remember, we're all on that 3-month free trial right now. So those numbers were not looking very good. But on the more positive side, they did show that 28% of Spotify premium customers and about 11% of Spotify's free users were also using Apple Music or trying out Apple Music. And they saw about 6% of Pandora users were doing the same thing. So Apple seems like they're getting a lot of people sort of testing out the service, moving over from other premium services, and maybe services that they're already paying on, as in the case of the 11%, or rather the 28% of Spotify premium customers. So they also noted that 30% of users said they were using Beats 1, and about 27%, and I found this very surprising, 27% of the people who were trying out Apple Music did say they were accessing the Connect service. That's the music artist social media service. And I have to tell you, I'm starting to use that a little bit more, too. I'm starting to find more artists that are active in that section, and I'm finding some new music and some new tracks from those artists through that area. So if you haven't checked out the Connect section in Apple Music, play around in there a little bit. I think you'll like it. Another interesting number is they still found that 64% of current users were extremely or very likely to pay for an Apple Music subscription. And this was right at the point when I was going through these numbers where I went, wait a minute, something's not jiving here. Because if you were listening closely earlier, you noticed that they said that 61% of the people they surveyed said they'd turned off the auto-renew subscription service. So these two numbers seem to contradict each other a little bit. And I would say if Apple can convert 64% of the people trying out Apple Music into paid music subscription subscribers. That's like a tongue twister. Say that a few times real fast. If they can do that, then they're going to do very, very well. I think Apple has reported themselves that they have about 11 million people trying out the service right now. So if they can convert 64% of those, I think Apple Music would be off to a pretty good start. And in a statement made to The Verge, Apple did come out and immediately refute these numbers. They said that 79% of people who signed up for the Apple Music free trial are still using Apple Music. So that would only amount to, 21% of people have sort of dropped off or canceled, not the 48% that was claimed by the Music Watch survey. So quite a bit of contradiction there. I guess you got to kind of decide who you want to believe, but do remember again that the Music Watch thing was only accounting for U.S. consumers, and Apple Music is available in over 100 countries. So I don't know how it's breaking out in terms of popularity between various countries, but interesting numbers. I don't think that they're as bleak though as the Music Watch survey seemed to indicate. Another quick thing related to Apple Music and what's going on. Apple did announce the Apple Music Festival, which was formerly known as the iTunes Music Festival. That's an event that happens every year in London. They get a bunch of acts to come together and give a free concert. You get tickets actually through a lottery system. The event is going to happen September 19th through September 28th at the Roundhouse in London. For the show, they announced acts like Pharrell, Florence and the Machine, One Direction, Disclosure, and more. If you are unable to get tickets through the lottery system, don't worry. Apple is going to broadcast the shows live and on demand via Apple Music, iTunes, and on the Apple TV. So if you want to see those concerts, you'll have plenty of opportunity. There's also this year going to be coverage on Beats One, and they say they're going to have glimpses and backstage sort of things happening over on Apple Music Connect. So Apple's definitely going to be leveraging the Apple Music ecosystem to give even more coverage to the new Apple Music Festival. And if you want all the details, you want to check out when you can see all the stuff, they do have a website set up at applemusicfestival.com. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at mattcast.com if you're interested in checking that stuff out. Apple appears to be making some big changes at the Apple retail stores. One of the biggest ones, actually something that I actually got to see today because I was in an Apple retail store and the switchover happened today. The iPods have been moved away from the tables in the sort of main area of the stores over to the accessory shelves. So you'll find them over there along the wall. And you'll literally be able to go in and just pick one up off the shelf and buy it. You could even use Apple's Easy Pay system, scan it yourself on your iPhone in the App Store app, or the Apple Store app rather, and walk out of the Apple Store. So no longer having to kind of pick it out and then have a salesperson from the floor go back and retrieve it for you. So that's a little bit of a change. Kind of shows that the iPod maybe isn't as much of Apple's featured ecosystem as it used to be. We saw a similar thing on the website with the change of removing the iPods from the top tab. It's now over there under the music section. Another really big change that you'll notice if you go into an Apple retail store now is the smart signs have been removed. Those are the little iPads that were next to the MacBooks and the iMacs and all those sorts of things that gave you the pricing information and more of the details. Apple will now have an app for that. So what they're going to do is they are going to preload the pricing information and product details onto the actual devices themselves, either onto the Macs or the phones or the iPads using apps. And a big reason being cited for this change is apparently consumers got confused by the signs, not realizing that they were actually not demo units. So they would go in there and they'd try and sort of test out an iPad on there and then suddenly realize, or not realize rather, that it wasn't actually a demo unit, that it was just presenting product information. So I guess they're going to try and make that a little bit more clear. I would imagine also it kind of cleans up the tables a little bit. And we had heard that Apple's trying to get sort of a cleaner, sleeker look. We've had that redesigned third-party packaging that's going to kind of match the Apple Store aesthetic. So I think some of that's coming into play here, though that wasn't specifically called out in these reports. But as far as how the new product information works, on the Macs, there's actually going to be an app positioned at the left side of the dock. And once you launch that, it is going to be fully interactive like the signs were. So it's going to have all the same features. You can call a person over to get help, you know, by clicking a little button. You can get all the product and pricing information, all those sorts of things. On the iOS devices, there's going to be an app on the home screen. The only thing about this, I think, that's going to be a little less intuitive is as you're on there, a lot of times when you walk up to those units, right, somebody has already launched some sort of application. Maybe the Photos application is open or iMovie or something like that. So it might not be readily obvious where you would go to get pricing information. And if it's not sitting out there right on the table, I think some consumers are going to need help from actually the representatives on the floor. But that may just be a better thing because they can come over, talk them more through product features and information and things like that, and you can get a little more personalized experience. So it'll be interesting to see how that changes the dynamic of walking into an Apple retail store and sort of trying out a product and getting that information. I'm not sure myself how I feel about it, but I'm going to have to try the experience, I guess, next time I'm in there, which is actually going to be this week. So that should be pretty good. And I wish I would have checked out, because I think the signage change should happen this week as well, but I wasn't paying attention. I noticed the iPods, but I didn't think to check that. But I'll be in there tomorrow night, so maybe on a future MacCast I can report on that experience. Another little change is they're not going to require Apple try-on appointments anymore, so you'll be able to go in and just ask to try on an Apple Watch and do that sort of thing. Another thing that hasn't happened yet that's a rumor is that Apple may be phasing out its one-to-one in-store training programs. And they also did just do an update on their website so that customers can more easily browse and schedule the workshop appointments. So those are more the sort of group appointments that happen or the little classes that happen. So you can go in there through the website. And that's under the store services section. And still in there is the one-to-one stuff. So I'm not sure when Apple will be phasing that out. But I would imagine that's just the sort of thing where it's not really efficient to do the one-to-one sort of training. And actually, honestly, one-to-one hadn't been one-to-one for a while. They were doing kind of little mini groups for that. I think the workshops are a little bit bigger. But that may be another change that you'll see happening over at Apple Retail. And then outside the Apple stores themselves, there's actually some pretty big changes happening with regards to Apple Watch and third-party retailers. Apple appears to be really quickly expanding the number of locations where you can go outside of the Apple ecosystem and buy an Apple Watch. It started with some Best Buy locations in the U.S. and Canada. I think they kind of did a limited rollout. And then we just saw a report recently that Apple has added Meijer locations across Australia. And most recently, the retailer FNAC in France. And then at the end of the week here, we got a report, or end of last week, I think it was, we got a report that Best Buy says their program had done so well in their limited rollout with Apple Watch in about 500 of their stores that they're actually going to be expanding and will begin selling in all 1,050 of their retail locations across the United States by the end of September. And that seems to really contradict some of the, you know, reports we heard a couple of weeks ago that Apple Watch sales were floundering. Apparently, Best Buy was able to sell a lot of them. And I think what might be happening here, and I'm purely speculating, is that the Apple Watch is resonating more just with the general consumers, you know, people looking at consumer electronics devices. And you've got a lot of those folks going into Best Buy stores. And, you know, it's us tech geeks who are being much more critical about the Apple Watch and what it does. And I think we talked about that on a prior MacCast. So I think the fact that Best Buy is doing really well is really an example of, hey, this is, you know, this is a product for the masses. And on a recent trip or recent trip to Legoland here that I had, I was surprised because I saw a ton of Apple Watches in the wild while I was there. I think I saw about five or six of them. And that was really neat to see. And I even saw, you know, one on a pretty young kid. I don't know if he was just wearing his mom's one for the day, but I found that interesting as well. So I think there is some popularity here. And, you know, now that availability has been sort of sorted out, I think we're going to see a lot more people with Apple Watches. I know I get asked constantly when I'm wearing mine about, you know, hey, do you like it? What are you using it for? That sort of stuff. And we're going to be talking about that a little bit later in this episode. Apple has a new ad out in its If It's Not an iPhone, It's Not an iPhone ad campaign. And this time around, they are featuring Apple Pay. And this was something I was hoping Apple was going to do, is actually kind of try and promote Apple Pay and get the word out a little bit more about it. Because as I've mentioned in the past, one of my frustrations is not having the ability to use it at a lot of retail locations. And the ad does focus on Apple Pay's benefits of being faster, more secure, keeping your privacy, so not giving up that information to retailers. But the big reveal at the end is, and you can already use it in 1 million stores. And to me, that seemed to imply that Apple Pay is kind of everywhere. You know, it's in a million places. You can use this everywhere. But really, that turns out to be a little bit misleading. I know, shocking for an ad campaign, right? But, you know, a big part of the spot is also highlighting some of the big chain stores that you can actually take, you know, that are actually taking Apple Pay and that you can use Apple Pay in. Stores like Whole Foods, Foot Locker, Toys R Us, McDonald's. And, you know, you get to a million because when you have big retailers like that, they have thousands or tens of thousands of stores in their chain. And so it's not really like, you know, hey, I can go use this at a million retailers. It is literally a million stores. And of course, yes, this is marketing and you're going to pump stuff up. You're going to give the impression that things are bigger and better than they really are. And that's the whole point. And it's good that Apple's getting the word out about Apple Pay and it should help. But again, you know, I still love Apple Pay. I love using it, but it's really hard to use because really only a few actual retail locations accept it. It is getting better, and I think campaigns like this will help, but really I think it's going to take Apple, you know, having foot soldiers, getting people out and partnering with retailers and even smaller mom and pops and stuff like that, doing some outreach programs. And I don't know if they aren't already doing all this stuff behind the scenes, and I don't know what challenges they're hitting. I'd love to kind of find out about that. Yeah, I don't know how that's possible, but we'll try to do that. I've been asking a lot of questions, asking a lot of people who I think should be in the know. And as I get information about that, I'll try and share it with you. Because I think Apple Pay really can be huge. I think it's really convenient. I use it as much as I possibly can. And every time I use it, it is a great experience. And if you haven't had the chance or you haven't tried Apple Pay, I would encourage you to try it out if you have the capability, either on your iPhone or it gets even better with Apple Watch. That's kind of one of the key features of Apple Watch. But again, we're gonna get into that more later, so I don't wanna spoil that. But I get excited sometimes talking about this stuff. Let's talk about next generation iPad Pro. I know we've been talking about it quite a bit, but it keeps coming back. You know, is it gonna show up this year? Is it not? KGI Securities analyst Ming-Chi Kuo says that the 12.9-inch iPad Pro is entering mass production sometime in September or October. This is according to something I read over on Mac Rumors. He says that the Pro iPad will be released along with a new Force Touch-enabled Bluetooth stylus. I'm not even really sure what that means, but it sounds cool, right? He says the technology is evolutionary, not really revolutionary. And the way it's put in this piece, it makes it sound like there's not going to be necessarily Force Touch in the display, but it's going to be something that's required through the use of the stylus. And it's still believed the stylus is going to be this optional accessory. So, you know, to me, it feels like Apple might be using Force Touch as a more general marketing term for various kinds of, and I hesitate to even call it pressure sensitivity, because I think, you know, when I think of pressure sensitivity, I'm thinking of something like a Wacom that has several thousand levels of pressure sensitivity. And I don't think that's what Force Touch is all about. Force Touch is more about sort of having extra layers of, you know, sort of this extra axis of a gesture kind of thing where, you know, I can press in and maybe there's 1, 2, 3, 4 levels of sort of pressure, but it's not true pressure sensitivity. And though, you know, Kuo's comments does make it sound like he thinks force touch style gestures would be built into the stylus, and you know, that the tablet isn't going to come with true like Wacom like pressure sensitivity. But I would think that especially for artist applications, that would be something that it needs. And he wasn't definitive on this next point, but he did note that Force Touch being built into the stylus could open up the possibility of it working with other iPad models if Apple actually wanted to add software support for that sort of thing. And I think that could be pretty cool. You know, you have an older iPad, and if the pressure sensitivity, the Force Touch is built into the stylus itself, then you can simply buy the accessory and sort of upgrade your other device. I only hesitate on saying that will be a thing because historically Apple will put new features into a new device to incentivize us to actually buy that new device, right? You want to keep it exclusive to the new thing, this big new feature, so that we have an incentive to upgrade. And I think this is something that Apple needs to do even more with the iPad because, as you know from listening to prior shows, Apple has been struggling with demand on the iPad side. And I think they expected this, I think, as a natural progression, as we've talked about, of the product line itself. But, you know, it's probably about time that Apple does give consumers sort of a big compelling reason to upgrade their current generation iPads. And since it sounds like we're not going to be getting an iPad Air 3, the iPad Pro would probably be that thing. We got a little more possible detail on what the screen is going to look like on the iPad Pro. Mobile analytics firm Apsy says that they are seeing test iPad Pros show up in their logs. And from that, they have determined the resolution looks to be about 2732 by 2048. And they're also seeing a model identifier on those logs of iPad 6.8. Which would be a new iPad model. And that resolution is backed up by some of the other rumors we've been hearing in the past. So it does seem like that will be the resolution of the next generation, or the new iPad Pro, rather. Some other key features beyond the stylus and the screen include it may come with a USB-C connector instead of a Lightning connector. I think that's a logical next step for actually all of Apple's devices. I'm not sure it's going to happen with the iPhone 6S and 6S Plus. I would think that's a maybe. I think those will still have Lightning connectors, but I think moving forward, especially with a big new model like an iPad Pro, Apple's going to want to switch over to the USB-C connector. They're also thinking the iPad Pro may have NFC capabilities in it, not for doing like Apple Pay payments, but more for being a point of sale or an Apple Pay payment terminal, which is a common use case for an iPad Air. And it'd be even nicer to have that as your payment terminal in a larger format like a 12.9-inch iPad Pro. So I think that's definitely a possibility. As far as whether or not Apple will show off the iPad Pro at the next upcoming event, some people are saying they don't think Apple will, that Apple will have the iPad shipping in late October, the iPad Pro rather, shipping in late October or early November. And the Apsy analysis, going back to that, it did show that the devices they were seeing in their logs were running a version of iOS that was labeled 9.1. Apple's currently working on 9.0, and you would think that would come out on any products that were announced at the next event. So that sort of points to maybe the iPad Pro is going to come out a little bit later along with an iOS 9.1 software update. So it could happen after, although DigiTimes says that Sharp has been tasked with supplying about 5 million displays and having those ready and over to Foxconn for handling the assembly for the new iPad Pro, and they're targeting a total of 4 to 5 million units by the end of the year. So if they're getting that late into the release cycle, not coming out to late October, early November, that's a pretty ambitious, I think, number to deliver 4 to 5 million, sell 4 to 5 million. That would be the implication by the end of the year. So I'm thinking, you know, it's very likely. I'm kind of 50-50 on this. I think there's a 50% chance Apple will have this ready to announce at the next event with the iPhones. And it may happen at an event later, but I think Apple's going to want to get everything sort of announced and out at the same time. And I see no reason why they couldn't announce the product and just say, hey, and it's shipping in, you know, late October, early November. So I think the announcement likely will happen of the iPad Pro in just a couple weeks. And speaking of that event, you know, the date for Apple's next big product event is pretty much agreed upon right now by the rumor sphere. Everybody's kind of pegging it as September 9th, a Wednesday. Typically, Apple's done it on a Tuesday, but, Wednesday can come into play as well. And more recently, the community seems to have agreed on when actual iPhone pre-orders will happen. It's seeming like it's going to happen the Friday after the event, so Friday, September 11th. The iPhone 6S and 6S Plus will go on sale on pre-sale, pre-order, and then shipments will happen the following week on Friday the 18th. So in stores on Friday the 18th and being delivered out to the pre-order consumers on the 18th. And that all seems to drive and make sense. And most also agree that this is going to be the biggest iPhone S update ever. I know we've covered some of this stuff in bits and pieces in the past, but just to kind of bring it all together, the iPhone 6S and 6S Plus are expected to have more RAM, I think 2 gigabytes now, or double the RAM, all new A9 processor, a new color in rose gold that will match the rose gold of the edition Apple Watch. It won't be real gold like the edition Apple Watch, but it will match in terms of the color. A strengthened shell that we're going to talk about here in a little bit. Improved Touch ID, Force Touch, as well as major upgrades to both cameras, both the front-facing FaceTime camera and the rear-facing EyeSight camera. So huge update for an S release year, and I think it's going to prompt a lot more upgrades than probably iPhone updates, S updates in the past. A lot of times people will kind of skip that one because it's an incremental upgrade, but sounding like this one's going to be far from just an incremental upgrade to the new larger iPhones. The event is also expected to feature an iPad Mini 4, also very likely new Apple TV hardware with apps, but no streaming service yet. And again, possibly the larger 12.9-inch iPad Pro, though some people are thinking that might be a separate event later in the fall. And one other thing related quickly to the iPad Pro, a crazy rumor that surfaced this week from IDC, they think the iPad Pro might actually be what's called what they're calling a detachable device. But think like a Surface device, something that has a, you know, a keyboard that goes along with the tablet itself. I think there's no chance of Apple doing that, but just wanted to mention that because that did come up in the rumor mill this week. And then we also have potentially the iPhone 6C being announced, but that really seems to be in flux, depending upon which source you want to believe. This week, a Chinese leak did mirror Evan Blass's comments, and Evan Blass has been a product leaker who has been accurate in the past. This Chinese site mirrored some of his comments that Apple would have a 4-inch iPhone 6C ready to go, although they gave a time frame of mid-November for the release date, whereas Blass thought that Apple would debut the 6C alongside the 6S and the 6S Plus. I think we mentioned that on the last episode. So you have those sources out there. And then on the other side of things, you've got, you know, KGI analyst Ming-Chi Kuo and DigiTimes, both who have had a track record of being right on occasion. Both of those sources are claiming that the 6C won't come out till sometime in 2016. So I don't know. I'm kind of on the fence on this. I think Apple will have a 6C ready to go. I think it's time for Apple to upgrade that line. And we've been hearing some great things about the upgrades. It's going to be a 4-inch display device. I think there's still a lot of people out there that like that size, like that form factor. It's expected to have an A8 processor and then bring into the 6C line Touch ID, which would include support for Apple Pay, very, very important, and just then a new design that matches the metal design of the iPhone 6S models. And I think that's important, too, because, you know, it sort of rounds out the lineup. You have an entry-level model, and then you've got your, you know, next size up, and then the big, larger size. And it sort of fits everybody, and it brings the entire iPhone ecosystem all together. And I think that's a good thing, and I think it's time for Apple to do that. So I'm hoping we see the iPhone 6C at this event. You know, I'm kind of putting that at a 66% chance of happening, but I think it very likely might. But if you take all of these things together, all these things that I'm talking about, I think by all accounts you can say this is going to be a huge event. This is going to be a huge release. I often call this Apple sort of barfing out products, right? All at once, just kind of blah. And we sit around speculating, waiting forever for this stuff to come out. And then they hit us all at once and then we're overwhelmed. At least I am in the media covering this stuff. But it's all fun, right? So this is going to be a big event, and it's looking like now Apple may have outgrown their old venues. They want to make a big splash here, and they want to apparently invite a lot of people because there's mounting evidence that Apple has rented out a place called the Bill Graham Civic Auditorium in San Francisco for this next event. Some sources have taken a look, and they've leaked some information, and the venue appears to be booked for a private event, a conference to be held sometime between September 4th through September 13th, so that fits in with the September 9th release date. And the documents also show plans for modifications to the venue's windows. And actually, this place kind of looks like some of the more elegant Apple retail stores, especially the ones in Europe, you know, with the big sort of rounded arched glass windows with the, you know, with all of the framing in it. And, you know, the ones where you see then a white Apple logo behind it. So it would make sense that Apple would want to put these logos up there. But the plans show modifications for four of the windows that would support these sort of 15-foot logos. Although in the drawings, they're these kind of wonky-looking stars. But Apple Insider does point out that the mounting frames for those would easily accommodate a different logo, you know, hint, an Apple logo. And the documents also showed that there would be closures around the venue from 6 p.m. on Tuesday, September 8th, so the night before event, which you would expect them to be kind of doing a load-in and setting up the event. And then also on Wednesday, September 9th, from 4 a.m. to noon. And that would be, you know, reportedly when news vans and all those things would be kind of coming in and setting up outside the venue. Apple typically launches the event around 10 a.m. Pacific time. So, and then they generally run 2 hours, so 10 to noon. It all kind of jives up. And in looking at this place, though, the Bill Graham Civic Auditorium, it's huge. It can accommodate up to 7,000 people. And just for perspective, that's more than twice the number of people as the Flint Center, which was where they announced the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus. And even that was a big venue for Apple. Did I say 6S? The iPhone 6 and 6 Plus, just in case I messed that up. And then it's more than four times the size of the Yerba Buena Center, which Apple has often used to also release new products. So it's seeming like Apple plans to pack this venue with a ton of press. And if they're going to do that, I think they're going to be making some really huge announcements, some really big things. And I think if you take the iPhone 6S and 6S Plus with all the big updates, you pile on an Apple TV update that includes apps and a bunch of new stuff, and then throw in an iPad Pro as your one more thing, I think by all accounts, this will be one of the most epic Apple events in recent history, for sure. And I would imagine we'll see announcements go out early next week, because we're getting pretty close to these dates, right? We're just a few weeks away. And with that many people, maybe, just maybe, this will be the year that MacCast gets an invite. Everybody cross your fingers, let's hope. Although it's very likely not going to happen. They typically don't invite us lowly podcasters. But, you know, maybe if they need to fill some seats, we'll get lucky this time around. We'll just have to wait and see if I get an invite invite next week. Now, this next story, I've actually kind of made fun of this a few places, most recently on the last iOS show. So in case you missed that, check out the iOS show at theiosshow.com. But it is the fact that recently many sites and pundits in our community have become seemingly obsessed with the material that the next iPhone is going to be made from. We've had this back and forth. Is it going to be 6,000 series aluminum or 7,000 series aluminum? And to be honest with you, I had no idea what that meant. You know, what is the difference between a 6,000 series aluminum and a 7,000 series aluminum? And why would it even matter? Why does it matter to us? Why does it matter to Apple? And luckily, a recent Unbox Therapy video surfaced. And if you remember, these are the guys who actually kicked off Bendgate. Remember that? Yeah. They put out that original video of the iPhone 6S Plus, I believe it was, bending. But, you know, this comes down to durability. And so this time around, they actually did a great video. They had a part they believed to be a back case for the iPhone 6S, and they did a great job of explaining what the difference between the aluminum materials were and actually showing and demonstrating why it really does kind of matter. And what they did was they did some actual scientific analysis of this back case and determined that it very likely is 7000 series. But backing up a little bit, so just so you know, 6000 series aluminum, I guess, apparently is the most common metal material used on the planet right now. You'll find it in everything, and it's mostly 97% aluminum. Has the advantage of that it's really easy to mill, it's readily available, it's very affordable because it's so readily available and so many people use it. So it's a very common material used in manufacturing things that are made out of aluminum. 7000 series, by contrast, which is actually the stuff that's used in the aluminum Apple Watch, the Sport Edition, is not quite as common. It's more expensive, and they say about five times as expensive as the 6000 series aluminum. And it's in its makeup, it has about 6% of zinc added to it. So it's a little less aluminum, and they add zinc. And the zinc is what adds the strength, but also has a little bit of a disadvantage of that it can lead to more chance for corrosion of the metal. And because of that, something they noted when they were analyzing this part was that it seems to have a much thicker layer of anodization, if I can say that word, have a much thicker layer of anodization on it, which may be compensating for the corrosion potential of the new case. And so the big deal here was that the 7000 series, when they actually put it through a machine to kind of force test it, it was able to withstand about 80 pounds of force before bending significantly. And remember, all they had was the back case part, not the entire phone itself. When they measured the older iPhone 6 back case, it only was able to withstand about 30 pounds. So the 7000 series was able to withstand more than twice the amount of force. And just for a reference point, the entire iPhone 6, when that was tested, it actually bent at about 70 pounds of force. So just this back case was actually able to withstand more force than the entire iPhone 6 itself. And so it is significantly stronger. And also remember that reports have stated that this new component is actually slightly lighter as well. So stronger and just a little bit lighter. And there's good odds that actually this metal isn't just straight up 7000 series aluminum, because if you remember when Apple announced the Apple Watch and they did all those little segments about talking about the metallurgy and how they got into metals and stuff like that, they said they took 7000 series aluminum for the Apple Watch and actually altered it to create a new alloy that they claimed was 60% stronger at one-third the density. So even the metal case, you know, might not just be straight up 7000 series aluminum. It could be tweaked a little bit. So that is, I guess, in essence, why we should care about why this was, you know, what material this is made out of is a big deal. Because, you know, stronger, more durable phones, iPhones, is, I think, a good thing, right? I think we can all agree on that. So there you go. I'm a little more interested in this story now, although, you know, it does seem to get down into some of the minutia. Yeah, nerds. So Apple TV sales. Is Apple doomed? Is it falling? Park Associates just released their U.S. streaming media device sales analysis for 2014. Wait, 2014? I'm bringing this up because so many places reported on this story this week. And they made it sound like this was a recent sort of survey, like, you know, we're almost through 2015. No, these numbers, just to be clear, are from 2014. So, well, last year, these numbers showed that Apple TV was ranked as the fourth most popular music streamer, at least by sales. And that was behind Roku, which was the biggest seller. They had 34% share, followed by Google, which had 23% share, followed by Fire TV, and they didn't give us a percentage here, and then the Apple TV in fourth. And unfortunately, in order to get this actual report, you have to pay about $3,200. So I don't have that in the MacCast budget. I wish I could give you the actual numbers for Fire TV and Apple TV. But, you know, somewhere under 23% is where those are. And Fire TV is ahead of Apple TV, at least according to the Park Associates numbers. And the big thing here is that in 2013, Apple TV was a bigger seller than Fire TV. So looking at the pie chart, the thing without the labels, I did try to kind of speculate. I'm guessing Fire TV around 17% and maybe around 12% for Apple TV. But more interestingly in this report, they said that 20% of U.S. households now own at least one or more streaming media player, and that 8% of those had at least one stick-type device, which, as you know, Apple doesn't make a stick form factor. That would be something like, you know, the Google, what do they call that, the Chromecast, or the Fire TV stick. And listener Brad mentioned to me in an email that, you know, maybe Apple should consider doing two models of Apple TV, with one being a stick. And I hadn't really thought about that, but it does, it is kind of interesting. It's an interesting thing to think about. Maybe Apple comes out with two models of Apple TV in this next release, a lower cost streaming only kind of device, maybe based on the current Apple TV 3 design and built into a smaller stick form factor. And then a more advanced version of the Apple TV with the app and gaming support we've been hearing about. And, you know, you have kind of two-tiered price points for the Apple TV. It's interesting, Brad. I don't think it's going to happen. I think Apple has no interest in doing a stick-style device. But I thought that was very interesting. And just to see this 8% number, you know, maybe it is a market that Apple should be looking into. They probably already are, and maybe they have considered it. Who knows? But next generation Apple TV should help with any kind of slumping sales. It has been a while since Apple has put out a new Apple TV, so these numbers didn't really surprise me. I don't think they're that shocking, Apple being in fourth place. But I think this year, in 2015, those numbers might actually turn around. If you own an iPhone 6 Plus, you want to listen to this next story, because the camera in your device may be defective. Apple has notified some owners of the iPhone 6 Plus via email that their camera units could be defective, and they're offering a free repair to fix the affected units. Apple says the issue could cause your photos to be blurry and affects a limited number of iPhone 6 Plus models sold between September 2014 and January 2015. They've put up a support page on their website where you can actually check your serial number to see if your unit is in the affected batch. I will have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com so you can find it easily. If your iPhone has been shooting blurry images, and again, this is the 6 Plus, if you've been experiencing blurry images from your camera and you show up in the range of affected units, you should contact either your Apple authorized service provider, an Apple retail store, or Apple technical support to arrange a repair. Now, if you go the Apple retail route, it does appear that the repairs are being made in store, and the repair will take about 20 to 30 minutes or so. That's assuming that they're not backed up and they have the parts available. I think a lot of people are going in to get this repair right now, so depending upon where your Apple store is, your experience may vary. And before you go in, you definitely want to back up your iPhone to iCloud or iTunes before going in to get the repair. They are going to just replace the camera unit, but just in case something goes wrong and they need to replace your entire phone, you want to be ready for that. You may also want to turn off your passcode lock, or probably better yet, just change the code, since once they take it back behind the Genius Bar, they're going to want to have the code to unlock it. Maybe you don't want to give your super secret private, you know, iPhone code up to the Genius Bar. But that's kind of up to you. I've had mixed reports on what actually happens if your iPhone serial number is in the range, but your iPhone is not taking blurry photos. Some people are saying that Apple will simply turn you away, saying your unit isn't affected and they won't do the fix for you. I can share my own experience with you, because I went into the Apple store to actually have this, because when I checked on the site, my iPhone 6 Plus was in the range, although I have not been getting blurry photos, not at least that I've noticed. I do have shaky hands, so very often I'll get blurry photos, but I think it's my own fault. but not consistently blurry photos. And it's my understanding if you have this issue, you definitely know you have this issue. Because what's going on is actually the little sensor, the active image stabilization sensor, is kicking on thinking that it needs to compensate for vibration when vibration isn't happening. Apparently, you can also tell if you have this issue if you're having issues with the autofocus. So if you tap and it's not focusing properly or it's doing weird things there, it could be another sign that you're actually having this issue. But regardless, I decided, you know, I'm going to go in and see if they will replace my camera unit. Because one thing I've been told by a pretty reliable source is that it's not a matter of if this is going to happen to your unit if you're in the serial number range. It's more a matter of when. And as a matter of fact, when I was in there, my genius told me that they'd actually seen the issue firsthand in a number of the unit and a number of iPhones owned by people who work at the store. And that sentiment has been mirrored by this other source that I was talking to. So, you know, this is an issue. I don't think it's a widespread issue, but, you know, again, if you're in the affected batch, you probably want to have it taken care of sooner than later. And so the question became, are they going to help you if you're not getting this issue? And so when I went in, they said, you know, I could wait, get the repair because I wasn't getting blurry photos, or that I could get my camera unit replaced if I wanted. Although the genius that I had my meeting with did also say sometimes the technician, if they get it back there and they can't replicate the issue, they may kick it back out saying, hey, we can't fix this yet. And it probably has to do with availability of parts, but I'm really just speculating on there. So, you know, whether or not you want to take yours in probably depends on where you're at with that. The good news is that if they won't fix your unit or if they tell you you have to wait, because they have identified the problem, they are extending the warranty for this part for another year or 2 years, depending upon what you have. So they're going to cover it for a full 3 years after the first retail date of sale. So whenever you bought it, you have 3 years from that date to actually get this covered, whether or not you have, you know, an active current AppleCare warranty. So this is outside of that, total of 3 years. So you will have some time if you, you're not currently impacted or can't get the fix. But I'm going to go ahead and try and get mine fixed. And I think that's probably a good course of action if you go on the website and discover your iPhone is in the serial number range. And then the last thing in the news for this week is kind of a weird story out of Europe. A news site over there is claiming that Apple is working on and developing smart bands with health tracking sensors as upgrades for the current generation Apple Watch. And they believe that the way this will work is you'll actually get a new band that connects to your Apple Watch's diagnostic port. And this is where this is one area where this story gets a little weird for me and why I think it's probably not true. That diagnostic port is really hard to access, first of all. And I can't imagine Apple asking consumers to have some sort of tool that they have to pry that thing out with just to hook up a new band that will allow them to upgrade their Apple Watch. I think it's a neat idea, and I think it's possibly something Apple has been playing around with and maybe testing, but I really don't think it's going to get released as an actual product. And the reason why is I think Apple will have Apple Watches in the future with more sensors, more health stuff built into it, but I think all that's going to come in actually a new Apple Watch. Still, there's sources that are saying that the connectivity and sensor options are possible via the bands because it was something that Apple has actually planned for. It's something they had thought about and it was one of the use cases for that diagnostic port. But I still think that a band with a bunch of sort of sensor warts on it, because I just don't think it would be that attractive. I don't think it falls into the Apple style of being simple. And more importantly, I don't think that Apple is really going to want people to be able to upgrade their older Apple Watches in lieu of, again, driving sales of new devices. They're going to want to put new features in new devices that are compelling and that people will want to upgrade for. And a lot of people, you know, sort of poo-poo that, saying, well, that's not really fair. Apple should, you know, allow us to kind of upgrade our older devices if they can. And, you know, I think the counter argument to that is, well, your Apple devices really hold their value. So you can turn around and resell an older device get a lot of your original investment back out and then go buy the new thing if you really want those new features. And if you're not that compelled, well, then you can just sort of hold off and wait for the next generation, wait for your natural sort of upgrade cycle to go around. And that's just historically how Apple has done things. You know, they're not an open ecosystem. And if you're moving into Apple's ecosystem, you kind of know that. So I really think they're going to stick to the status quo. I think we're going to get an Apple Watch 2 probably, you know, within 12 to 18 months of the original launch, so sometime next year. And then it'll have a bunch of new features and functionality and new sensors and probably be able to do a whole lot more cool things than the current generation. And that's just sort of the way it goes. But if you want to share your comments, your thoughts, opinions on this or any other story, you know, shoot me an email, mattcast@gmail.com. And I look forward to hearing from you. And speaking of Apple Watch, moving into the feedback section, I actually received a comment and a question from Gary about Apple Watch.
Hey, Adam, it's Gary. I think I provided a feedback on Apple Watch, like since I had it and the different, you know, features it didn't have or did have that it thought it needed, etc. It seems like everyone out there in the media is circling back to Apple Watch, the use cases, how they use it, why they use it, what's the most valuable feature, etc. So I thought maybe I'd circle back to that and give you some feedback, and maybe on one of your shows you could ask some other listeners that have Apple Watch, provide some feedback, because it'd be interesting to hear from not necessarily regular people, but people that are part of the listeners of the MacCast, what they think about the Apple Watch and how they use it. So here's mine. You know, it seems like the first thing people want to know about Apple Watch is, what's your use case? What do you find most valuable about it? And for me, I wanted an activity tracker that I could replace others. And what I've really found as my like call out feature is this vibration that happens on your wrist, that haptic feedback. And I use it to wake up with as my alarm clock. So it replaced my iPhone being by my bedside, being my alarm clock. I just use the kind of silent wrist vibration to wake up with, which I find pretty valuable. I don't have to go very far to turn it on or off. It's got a sleep feature and or snooze rather, and I can dismiss it from there and it doesn't wake anyone else up. So I find that a really attractive feature. I know that's available on other devices, like Fitbit has that feature, I believe, in certain models, that you can set an alarm to vibrate. So I really like that feature.
Hey, Gary, that's cool. I think your message might have got cut off a little bit there at the end. I'm not sure really what happened there. But I think we get the gist of what you're trying to ask, and also your use case. I'm curious to know, if you want to reply back, how are you handling battery? Because a lot of people, you know, myself included, I put my watch on the charger every night. So I'm guessing you have a little bit of a different charging regimen than some people to be able to wear it at night and have it wake you up. But I mean, that's the whole thing about the Apple Watch, right? It's going to be this personal device that we're all going to use in very personal and very potentially different ways. I mean, there's going to be some crossover, but I think everybody kind of finds their way with Apple Watch. And we're going to comment on some things, some comments made by Andy Yanako a little bit later that I think goes into that a little bit more deeply. But here's a use case for you. How about possibly saving your friend's life? You know, I often talk about having the Apple Watch and how it helps me better triage notifications, and most of the time ignore them. But here's another thing, and you mentioned this a little bit with the taptic feedback thing, right? Getting that little vibration on your wrist can be also very important, letting you know about urgent things that you need to know about and see and act on those urgent requests. And that's what actually happened to Ryan. He sent me an email and said, you know, they were on holiday and it sounds like possibly doing some sort of motorbiking trip in the mountains of Cyprus. And he had a friend who was alone and about 10 miles away from him when, unfortunately, he had a serious accident. And luckily, he was able to crawl to the side of the road and get to his iPhone and sent a message to, you know, an iMessage to Ryan and another friend as an SOS. And luckily, Ryan felt and saw the message on his Apple Watch. And that enabled him to respond much more quickly to his friend, to call and get help sent out to him. And Ryan had said if it had just been his iPhone, which would have been in his pocket as he was driving along, he likely would have ignored the notification until he actually reached his destination, which was about 20 miles away. So it would have been a lot longer before he could have gotten help to his friend. And unfortunately, his friend had head trauma and pelvic trauma, a broken collarbone, a lot of scrapes and bruises. Luckily, he's going to be okay. But, you know, it makes you wonder how much of that is the fact that he was able to get help to him much more quickly. You know, who knows how long he could have been lying there. So, I mean, it sounds almost, you know, like, is that really going to happen to a lot of people? But we've had some other stories like this. I think there was a story about a climber or somebody who fell and was able to, you know, get help via the Apple Watch. So there's that. But, you know, for me, I think the killer feature has really been, again, the notifications, being able to what I call triage my notifications, not always having to look down at my phone. I can simply glance at my watch in a much more subtle fashion, see if it is an urgent message or if it's something that I can literally ignore. Here's an interesting one. How about telling the time? You know, somebody asked me about this recently, and I gave that as one of the key features. Yeah, I can tell the time on it, and it's really convenient to have the time on your wrist and not to have to be constantly reaching into your pocket just to know what time it is. And just like you mentioned a little bit with the alarm, Gary, for me, it's timers. I find myself setting a lot of timers and little timed reminders when I have to do something. I have to follow up on something or just need to be reminded of something. I'll set a timer using the Apple Watch, using the voice commands, using Siri. And that's really, really convenient. And then I get a little tap on my wrist when it's, you know, when it's time to respond to that. And I do use Siri a lot, too, for the interactions. I think that's really key into getting more use out of your Apple Watch, is learning to be comfortable using Siri, lifting your wrist and using the, you know, Siri command to actually do voice control. And that goes for, you know, responding to emails or responding to messages and dialing the phone and all those sorts of things. So getting really comfortable for that. And, you know, in a pinch, once or twice, I actually have used it to make and receive phone calls. And that works really well. Oftentimes, actually, I think every time now that I really think about it, no one has mentioned, hey, I'm having trouble hearing you. Or they don't even probably realize that I'm actually taking the call on my Apple Watch. And I think that's great. And, you know, so there's all those use cases right now. I think the main deficiency that I've had with my Apple Watch is the applications not being native. They tend to run a little slowly. I also think some of the problems with third-party apps is more on the app design side, not understanding exactly the kinds of interactions and things that should be done on a watch. I think some apps are a little more ambitious than they probably should be, and they haven't really figured out the sort of use case. But I think that's going to change drastically once we have native applications. And that's just, you know, a couple weeks away now at this point, likely. So once we have that, I think that's really, really going to change. But the last thing sort of related to this that I wanted to point out is that Andy Iannocco wrote a great piece over at the Sun-Times called A Dozen True Things About Smartwatches. And he really took a look at the whole ecosystem. He's been going through a lot of smartwatches, and come up with some really great insights. And I'm just going to give the 12 items, just the 12 bullet points, and comment on a couple of them. But you really should read his whole piece. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at macguest.com. It's a great piece, and it really brings up a lot of these topics. And I think you'll see this just from the 12 bullet points that he pointed out. And so number one was your opinions on device X are completely without value until you've been wearing it for at least 2 weeks. I think a lot of people try on an Apple Watch, poke around on it, you know, at the Apple store, and then immediately form an opinion. Or you've probably seen some reviews like this where a reviewer gets a review unit, has it for a day or less, and, you know, forms a big long column about that. And you can't do that. This is especially true for the Apple Watch. You know, it took me weeks to figure out what my actual use cases were, you know, to figure out how does this fit into my life? What are the things where I can leverage this and it works really well to do A, B, and C? And, oh, hey, you know, X, Y, Z, these are really bad. This is something I'd rather have my phone out for, and those sorts of things. And figuring that stuff out takes time. I'm still figuring that stuff out here months into it. So that's, I think, a really important one. A smartwatch is a custom fit experience. And that's more so than any other device to date. It really is this personal thing. And you need this time to, as Andy puts it, get to know each other, right? You've got to sort of get intimate with this thing and figure out, where are my use cases? What is this thing good for? And everybody's going to come to, as I mentioned earlier, a different conclusion on that. Number three, oddly enough, these things are useful as wristwatches. Going back to one of my favorite features from earlier, it is good at telling the time. It is a good timepiece. And a lot of us haven't worn timepieces in a long time. And rediscovering that is actually a really great experience. So that's a big part of the experience. Number four, extended battery life is not a significant feature, right? Most people, when they wear a watch, they go to bed at night and they tend to take the watch off and put it on their nightstand. As Andy says, it's not that much more difficult to put it on a charger. So if you're getting a day plus worth of battery life out of it, and I do that with my Apple Watch, it sounds like, you are too, Gary, especially if you're wearing it all night. I've had those times when I forgot to put it on the charger, and it'll go another half a day, even sometimes a full second day, depending upon how I'm using it. And I think that's plenty of battery life. So obsessing about the battery life is something I don't think you need to do. As a matter of fact, I even turned off, one of the complications I used to use was the battery life indicator. I just turned that off because it just wasn't something I needed to obsess over or look at. Throw it on the charger every night and you're good to go. Number five, the most valuable life-affirming role of a smartwatch is to defend the user from his or her phone. Absolutely true. My favorite feature, hands down, is being able to triage my messages and notifications and not have to use my phone as much. And I really like that. I really like the convenience of not constantly reaching into my pocket and pulling out the phone. And I think that can't be understated. it really is a big deal. Number six is really about apps and developers and the experiences. He says there's a shot clock running on almost all positive interactions with a smartwatch. If what you need to do can't be accomplished on the watch in just a few seconds, I mean, your every interaction should, and the best interactions that I've had with it are just a few seconds long. If it's getting longer than, 3 to 5 seconds, it's probably too long of an interaction and it needs to be rethought. And I think developers are really going to need to look long and hard at that and sort of figure it out. Number seven, voice is by far the most useful and satisfying interface for a smartwatch. Absolutely true. You don't have a keyboard. You don't have a lot of buttons to click on. And you shouldn't. Using your voice is probably the best way to do most input or most complex input on the device. And it kind of goes along with number eight in his list, which is clicky buttons are a tough sell. You don't want a bunch of clicky buttons on your device. The Apple Watch has two little buttons on it, and that may even be too much. They could probably even at some point simplify it more. I would totally agree with that. Number nine, great smartwatches anticipate, need, and can deliver value without any interaction from the user. I think this is one area where Apple needs to really do a lot more work. This is one area where I think the Apple Watch can really be a lot better. Glances need to be smarter. I shouldn't have to swipe up to bring up a glance. It should know in advance what information I'm likely looking for and offer me those as options when I lift, when I lift the thing up to take a look at it. So it should be able to give me quick one-tap sort of options. Hey, you have a meeting coming up in 30 minutes. Do you need details, directions? Do you need to send a text? Give me some logical next step options, sort of anticipate what I might be wanting to do on my watch at that moment. And I think it will make it a much more useful device. It needs to be a little bit smarter, a smarter smartwatch. Number 10, smartwatch apps kind of suck. Totally true right now. I think that is going to change again as developers sort of figure things out and figure out that, hey, these need to be quick interactions. This needs to be an additive thing to maybe a more complex application that I have on my phone. All those sorts of things. Once we get native apps, right now performance is an issue for sure. So these need to be super lightweight, super fast apps that do really useful things. And I think that's just a matter of time in solving that one. Number 11, in 2015, most of a smartwatch's useful and delightful functions are bone simple and available from all manufacturers. And that's really true. You know, if you look at the Pebble and the Galaxy stuff and the Apple stuff, one of those most useful features is the notifications thing, and they all do that. So I think that is definitely true. And number 12, a smartwatch also works well as a second screen for a phone. I'm not really sure on that one. I'd probably need to dig a little bit deeper into it, but I think I get what he's getting at there. And I thought those were really great. That was just a really great list. Again, go back and read the whole article. I think you'll find it very informative if you have at all an interest in Apple Watch stuff. And Gary, I hope this sort of helps out. And hopefully some of you have some additional stories to answer Gary's question. If you do, send me an audio comment or an email, and we'll try and share some of those on future episodes of the MacCast. Now let's talk a little bit about photos, and more specifically, fixing dates on your photos. This topic's come up a few times in the past on the MacCast. I think it's been a little while since we've discussed it. Jim emailed me this week with a story of, unfortunately, woe relating to his switching from Windows to the Mac. And this relates specifically to his photos. I think overall, most of the experience went pretty well for you, right, Jim? But in the case of switching from the Mac, this was back in 2014, he used Migration Assistant to transfer all the files from his PC to his Mac. And that would include his files, his documents, music, and photos. And then he discovered trouble when he noticed that with his photos, they all had the wrong dates when he sorted from oldest to newest. So what appeared to happen was that it brought everything in with the import dates, you know, the transfer date when he ran Migration Assistant. So all the photo dates were off. And Jim, I think the issue here is that Apple does not use the photos EXIF data, you know, the actual metadata that's in the photos and stored in there when it puts stuff into the photos application. Even I think this goes back to iPhoto. What they actually use is the file created and modified date. And I would almost say this is kind of a feature bug that Apple has had, or just a philosophical bug. I really think they should probably be, you know, defer to the EXIF data, this data that's actually stored on the photo, which would be, you know, embedded on the date that the photo was taken, rather than using these created modified dates. And I'm purely speculating on this. I think this is what's going on. And my best guess is that, you know, that info was updated when you did the migration. So that's why you're having this sorting trouble. And I wasn't 100% sure when I received your email actually how to fix this. I thought, you know, the first thing I thought was obviously you could go in and use the image adjust date and time option in the photos application itself. But you kind of have to go one by one for that, and that would be very time-consuming depending upon the size of your photo library. And you'd also probably have to go in and check, because there are, you know, in photos currently they have the wrong dates. You'd have to go in and check the EXIF data on each image. So you'd kind of have to select the image, get info, look at the EXIF data. Okay, that's the date it should be. Then, you know, change the date. And doing that over and over again would just be a nightmare. So I did some more searching and found out that the folks who make a Better Finder renamer, which, by the way, is a great batch file renamer for the Mac, they make a tool called Photo Date Changer. It's $7.99 US on the Mac App Store. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But I think it has the feature that you need. What it'll do is it'll let you synchronize the photo's file creation and modified dates with the shooting date of the JPEG's EXIF data. And they say also with the EXIF data from many RAW formats. So the only caveat with this is that they might not support all RAW formats. So if your photos are in RAW, you might want to check the website for Photo Date Changer and just make sure it has support for your camera. But if your stuff's in JPEG, I think you should be good to go. And what it'll do is it'll let you batch reprocess your images and then import them back into the Photos application. So what I would do is first back up all your photos, back up the photo library as well, and then export all of the photos that you need to fix. So go into the Photos application, select all the ones you need to fix, and then go in the File menu, go under Export, and choose Export Unmodified Originals. Now, if you have some of those files that you've edited in the Photos application, you may need to go in and export those and then, you know, sort of pick the JPEG maximum quality and full-sized options. But if you can do just the original unmodified photos, I think that's going to be your fastest, best way to export. So pick whatever way, get them exported out to the desktop, and then I would even back up the exported images just because I'm obsessive about backup. If you've been listening to the show for any length of time, you know that. So I'd have multiple backups. And then, and mainly I'd want to back up the exported images just so I don't have to do that again in case I somehow mess up the photo date changer thing. But then take those exported photos and use Photo Date Changer to synchronize the dates, synchronizing the XF data and making that the file creation and modified dates on the files. And then once you have those done, then you could go back in, and because you have, you know, the prior backup of your photos in your photo library, go back in and delete the bad date photos from the photo application and then import the fixed ones, the ones that you just exported from Photo Date Changer. Simply grab them all and drag them onto the photos icon, and that should re-import them. And because they now would have the correct file created and modified dates, they should come into the photos application with the correct dates. So hopefully, if all goes well, that will work for you, Jim. And that's the best way I think I could think of to fix this. If you have a different method for doing this, if you've run into this issue in the past and you know of something better, please let us know. Send me an email, mattkess@gmail.com. And Jim, if I find out something better, I'll be sure to let you know about it on a future episode or via an email. And thanks for your email. Sorry you had so much trouble with your photos, but glad you're in our little Mac community and ecosystem, and hopefully all the other switching stuff went well for you. All right, the last thing that I want to talk about today is my little tale of frustration with specifically booking a Genius Bar appointment for this, you know, for this iPhone issue. So I needed to go into the Apple Store. Actually, originally it was for a broken vibration sensor on my wife's iPhone, and then I found out about the camera thing on the iPhone 6 Plus and decided to sort of put them together, which, after getting to the Apple retail store, I was told you really need to have separate appointments if you have separate devices. So just a word of advice, if you're going in for, you know, two different iPhones, make two different appointments, just put them back to back. But they were nice and let me go ahead and service both things on the one appointment. But that may not always be the case. But sort of back to this story. So I wanted to make a Genius Bar appointment for my wife's broken iPhone. I needed to take it in there and, you know, I think the right thing to do, make an appointment, and then you won't have any problems when you get to the store, right? So I tried to do it on Apple's website, which I've done in the past, and it's gone beautifully. So I did the usual thing. I go to the retail store page, the retail store I want to, you know, have the Genius Bar appointment at. I click on the Genius Bar icon under Store Services. I click on iPhone because I want to talk to them about the iPhone. And then everything went all wrong on me. I was expecting to see the options for the days and times for scheduling my appointment. That's how it's worked in the past. Well, Apple apparently has changed things, at least on the Apple.com website, the retail website. And instead, what I saw was a bunch of boxes for the category of my issue. And I thought, okay, no big deal. They just want more information. So it's like, you know, what's wrong with your iPhone? And you've got a bunch of boxes of choices. And so I click on the last one, which is service requests and troubleshooting, because I want to make a service request, right? Well, then I'm presented with more choices. No, I want to just make a Genius Bar appointment. Please let me make a Genius Bar appointment. No, I have more choices. Okay, I'll play along. I think this looks like missing ringtones and alerts. And so I click on that little box. And now I'm being asked more questions. So they're kind of walking me through, you know, is this the problem? Yes or no? And so I answer no, because what they present me is not the problem. And then they bring up a page saying, well, how would you like help? Great, we're making progress. I have options here. Although the first recommended option is send in for service, which allows me to sort of, you know, create a label and send it in. It's like, no, I don't want to send it in. I want to talk to a fracking genius. I want a Genius Bar appointment. Let me make it. Can you tell I'm getting frustrated at this point? So luckily on that same page is, you know, just down below a little bit is a visit the Genius Bar box. So I click on that thinking, yes, now I'm going to have my days and times to schedule my appointment. No. What does it show me? A map. Why am I seeing a map? It wants me to pick my store again. Didn't I start there? That was the first step. Remember, I went to the retail store page for the store I wanted the Genius Bar appointment at, and I clicked it. Yes. Okay. So frustrated. I map. I click the store I want. I have to sign in to my Apple account. That's normal. And then, finally, there's the days and times. So I can pick my day and time. But WTF, it's Friday morning when I'm trying to make this appointment. The earliest available appointment, next Wednesday. So I'm a clever dude, right? I know about this stuff. Guess what? There's 6 Apple retail stores within an hour drive of me. I'll just pick a different store, right? Get in sooner. Maybe I can go on Saturday, which is when I really want to go. Nope. Wednesday is still the soonest one out of all 6 stores. Some stores I couldn't even get into for over 5 days. You think they're a little backed up at the Genius Bar? You think this is something that maybe Apple would want to address? I think so, right? It shouldn't take 5 days to get a Genius Bar appointment. I think they need to do something here. But here's the rub. A source I know told me that Apple knows it's bad at the Genius Bar right now. And it appears like instead of staffing up, what they're asking their geniuses to do is cram more people in, rush them through, get stuff done quicker, take people 2 at a time. These are the kinds of things they're being told. If you're a genius and this is happening to you, I feel really sorry for you. Because it seems like Apple has some cash around that they could probably hire some more geniuses and train some more geniuses and get more people in there. If they have that big of demand for service, they probably should be doing a little bit more. So at this point, my advice to you, if you need a Genius Bar appointment and you can't get in, Apple does take walk-ins. And this is the sort of silver lining in this story is me reminding you, they do have a walk-in option now. And at this point, in a lot of cases, if this is how backed up the Genius Bar is, then it's probably a better bet. Because I think not as many people know about the walk-in option because Apple hasn't had this for very long. It doesn't necessarily guarantee that you're going to be able to get in and be seen. But they do have a system, and it works pretty well because I've used it a couple times. You walk in, you say, when's the next available appointment? Because they'll ask you, do you have an appointment? No. Okay, when's the next available appointment? Can you kind of get me in? And they'll tell you how backed up they are. In some cases, they might just say, we really don't have anything for you. But in many cases, what they'll say is, we can see you in 20 minutes, 30 minutes, maybe an hour. And what's really cool is they take your information and they will text you when it's time to come back to the store. And most Apple retail stores are in malls or in sort of shopping areas. So you can kind of go off, do a little shopping, maybe go to the food court, get some food while you wait for your appointment. And they will start to send you like 3 texts. They'll send you a text when they're almost getting ready for you, a text when they say, hey, come back to the retail store. And then once you're back in the store, they'll send you a final text when they're actually ready to see you. And it's really convenient and it works really, really well. So there's that. Also, I will point out, because some of you are probably thinking this already, I did end up, when I was going through all this sort of scheduling, I just want to schedule a Genius Bar appointment. I did go through and try going through the Apple Store app, and that is much more straightforward. It still has the old system. You go to the store you want, you click on Genius Bar and click on make an appointment, and you're immediately making an appointment. So no silly questions. No silly redirection, no getting caught in this sort of, twisted web version of a, phone queue number system or wherever. It's like, press 1 for this, press 2 for that. It really felt like that when I was going through it, and it was super frustrating. So I know what Apple's trying to do. They're trying to get you the answer ahead of time so you don't have to actually go in and back up the Genius Bar. And I think in some cases that works, but a lot of times for me, I've already done all that research, right? I kind of been through this before. I know at this point I have a problem that I can't solve and I need a genius to help me out. And Apple just let me make my appointment. So I'll be using the Apple Store or the Apple Store app from now on. And If you run into this problem, that's probably what you want to do as well. All right, I think that rant's over, and I think we are done for this show. One last thing I want to tell you about, because this is kind of fun. I was invited recently to be on the new Trivia Geeks podcast. So I am on the latest episode. I think it should be out by the time you hear this. If it's not, it will be the next episode that they have. But you'll want to check that out. You can see how well I do or how I embarrass myself. The bonus round questions were Mac and Apple questions. So, you know, I get tested to see if I really know my stuff. I won't give it away. You need to check out the episode. You can find it on iTunes. You can find it via their Facebook page, which I'll have a link to in the show notes at maccast.com. And it was video. They broadcast it through Twitch TV. So there's also a Twitch TV stream that you can check out, or I think it'll show up over on YouTube. So all the links to that will be in the show notes at maccast.com. Check that out, because it was a lot of fun. Great new podcast. So if you're looking for a new podcast and you're into trivia too, you probably want to check that one out. But with that, that is going to do it. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander Touch for your iOS devices, as well as PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can check out all their great software, get more information and details over at smilesoftware.com/MacCast. Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. And TunnelBear. TunnelBear is a really simple VPN app that allows you to browse privately and get around blocked websites. You can try it today by going to tunnelbear.com/MacCast. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. They are at CacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. You can find them at backbeatmedia.com. If you have any comments, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can email me at maccast@gmail.com. Feel free also to send in audio comments there. If you'd prefer to just call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail, you can do that as well. That number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. Or you can leave voicemail on Skype. My Skype username is the MacCast. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you're on the social medias, if you do that socially social thing, you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or you can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. Or if Google Plus is your social weapon of choice, we do have a Google Plus page. You can find that at google.com/plus, and that's the plus symbol, /plusMacCast. And I look forward to seeing you online. But that'll do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.